Hello and welcome to Link Set Podcast. Now, today's a bit of a different episode for me, where I do my first interview with legendary boxer and actor Jack O'Halloran. Now, in this interview, there is a bit of a technical glitch where he was talking about Steve McQueen and he had mentioned that he trained a guy, Frankie Lowry, before he left boxing. But you don't hear that because the audio kind of cut out and it got a little screwed up. We only lost probably about 25 to 30 seconds of the conversation. But when he mentioned Steve McQueen, he mentioned Frankie Lowry real quick. And then he mentioned how Robert Mitchum actually got him into acting. But you really didn't miss much. Like I said, probably only about 25 to 30 seconds of stuff that I missed due to technical issues. But I really hope you enjoy this interview because I do plan on doing some more of them. So sit back and enjoy my conversation with Jack O'Halloran. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Latent Cassette Podcast. Today's a special episode, and I will be interviewing a man who composed a 34-21-2 record as a professional boxer. He is in the California Boxing Hall of Fame, the New Jersey Boxing Hall of Fame. He has been in many movies and TV shows, including 1976's King Kong. Superman and Superman 2 and Dragnet are among his most well-known roles. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Jack O'Halloran. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thanks. Very well indeed.
Go ahead. You have quite an interesting story. You may be the most interesting man in the world.
I've done a few things in my life, you know?
Oh, definitely. I'd like to start at the beginning. What was it like growing up in Philadelphia in the 40s and 50s?
And, you know, when I compare to what's going on today, you know, we had a great life. You know, it was, neighborhoods were, you know, you talked to your neighbors, jumped back and forth with each other. There was no, you know, you played in the streets from sunset to sundown. And, you know, I never locked my front door. No one ever would think about robbing your house. You know, in the summertime, there was no air conditioning. People used to sleep out in their backyards, you know, they put webbings up for the mosquitoes and they'd sleep outside because it was cooler. And, you know, so it was a whole different, atmosphere. And of course, I had a very famous father in New York, so people looked after my house and myself and my mother anyway. So it was, a lot better way of life, I think, and much healthier for kids.
Oh, for sure. I see a lot of kids walking around with, like, the iPads and stuff, and we didn't even have that when I was growing up in the 90s. It's like...
iPads, wow. You know, we still had telephones that went through operators and stuff, you know? It was party lines. You know, they had what they call a party line. And then you go to answer your phone, you know, who else was listening. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it sounds like it. You alluded to it a little bit ago. Your father was one of the most well-known mobsters of the early 20th century, Albert Anastasia. How'd you find out about your fatherhood? Is that something you always knew, or is that something your mother told you?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I had a minder around me when I was younger. It was an Irish guy who, Rip Collins, whose brother was an infamous guy in the IRA in Ireland. And Rip was an engineer for General Electric, and he ran the waterfront for the IRA in Philly. My father ran all the waterfronts, so they were good friends. And he was a friend of my mother's, so he was like a minder to me and taught me a whole bunch of things when I was younger. And never told me who I really was, but that I was a special person, and one day I would find out. You know, so, but he more or less prepared me for what was coming.
Right.
And I never found out until I met my father once, right before he was assassinated, and I was supposed to go to New York to meet him, to sit down and have a meeting with him, and the assassination happened. Then I was tutored by Meyer Lansky and Frank Costello and Charlie Luciano and other people. And I was 14 years old, so it was an eye opener.
Yeah, that was quite interesting. Do you have any kind of relationship with your father's family today, or is it kind of distant?
Yeah, we don't really. really, we don't have a real family closeness, but we're there for each other. You know, we all know each other. And I have my own relationships with people in Boston and New York and most of the city and Europe and everywhere with the familia, where my father came from and everything. And I was a made individual when I was 19 years old. And so you never really are away from any of that. And once you're in the door, you're in the door. The friendships and everything are there, but I went away and did my own life. And, you know, if I would have listened to people, certain things would have happened a different way, but I never wanted to cross swords with certain things. So, you know,
when you say you were made, when you say you were made, does that mean you were like in?
Yeah, I went through the ceremony and all when I was in down in Sicily. And so I've practiced omerta all my life.
Okay. What is that for maybe people who don't know?
It's a code of silence.
Okay.
Omerta, you know, you just, I would never ever turn rat on anybody or anything of that nature. You know, I'd go to jail before I would do that.
Right.
So I didn't put myself in any situations that would put me in a bad position. You know, I did some things when I was younger and I walked away from them. So, you know, it worked out okay. You know, in those days, there was a lot of political power and there was a lot of power. I mean, you got to go understand something that in the very beginning, government, industry, organized crime and unions were all partners. They all helped each other. And a lot of illicit monies that were made by organized crime went back into the growth of a country. Because their initial deal was gambling and loan sharking and extortion. If you didn't have money, how could you pay them? So they made sure you went to work. And they controlled the unions, and my father controlled the waterfronts. And, you know, they invested a lot of money back into the country and the different construction companies and to trash companies and Sears and Roebuck and, you know, General Electric and the insurance companies. They put a lot of money back into the growth of a country, and no one ever talks about that. You know, everybody wants to throw a different slant on things, and, you know. We're getting ready to change a lot of that because I've written a book called Family Legacy, and Lucky Luciano's son and I are very close, and he's got his father's last book, and we're going to tell the truth about a lot of things that happened in the course of years, and a lot of things that people, conspiracy theories that people, you know, Hollywood takes for granted and does different things and exploits things. And, you know, the last thing they just did, which really irked me a bit, was they did this picture of the Irishman. And I knew Frank very well, Sharon, and I knew Russell Buffalino was a dear friend of mine. And Frank Sheeran never killed Hoffa, and he never killed Joey Gallo. So Hollywood took a liberty, you know, saying that he did this and he did that. And Sheeran was a driver for Hoffa. And Russell Buffalino's nephew was his lawyer. Billy was Hoffa's lawyer. If Russell saw the Irishman picture, he would turn over in his grave. Someone wouldn't be walking around
with that. I actually did have that question for later on, but I'll just ask you now since we're talking about it. Do you think that the majority of the Hollywood movies, like when they talk about the mob and stuff, do you think they usually get it wrong? Do they get it close?
Oh, no. They get so much stuff wrong. It's pathetic. And you know, the ironic part about it is that's the reason why we're getting ready to do what we're going to do, is that no one has a crystal ball in the movie world. You know, you can't say this picture is going to make money or that picture is going to make money. But there's genres, and the genre of organized crime has always made money. There's not one picture ever done about organized crime that's ever lost money. Mm-hmm. Even the spoofs that they do make money. You understand?
Yeah.
So if you come around and you tell the truth about certain things, it's going to your audience goes from, you know, like I wrote this book and there's reviews on Amazon and there's people 90 years old who did a review and said, what, this is like 80% true because I lived it. The names are there, the things are there. I lived in the era that these people rule our cities. And, you know, so people want to hear the truth. They're really tired of being led around by their nose and you know, and no one really telling the truth about certain things that happen. So we're going to do that. You know, we're going to tell the truth about a lot of things in our history. You know, it's like the Kennedy assassination. People tell 20 different conspiracy theories. So I tell the truth in the end of my book. I just, you know, I tell the truth about what really went on, and you know, and then, and we're going to even exploit on that a lot more, and a lot of things in politics that happened that people are blindsided with, you know, like Hollywood made Al Capone a huge figure. Al Capone wasn't that big a figure in real life. He was a shooter, and he created a lot of chaos in Chicago. But when they wanted to quell him down, Charlie Luciano invited him to Atlantic City when they put the commission together in 31. And he told him, and he said, and Al thought he was being brought out there to be part of something. And Charlie said, tomorrow, you're going into a movie theater in Philadelphia with a gun in your pocket, and you're going to go to jail. And that's what happened to him. He got locked up, and he spent a year in Pennsylvania prison. And when he went back to Chicago, they were waiting for him for the tax evasion thing, and he went to jail. And they let him out of jail because he was dying of syphilis, and he died in Florida, very unknown. But that was better than making a martyr out of him.
Yeah.
Understand? And I can tell you several examples like that. So you've had Hollywood has exploited a lot of things and taken advantage, like, you know, of this death and that death, Hoffa's death, and, you know, nobody really has ever told the truth about Jimmy. And where he's at and everything else. And we're going to do all that, you know. So it's about that. So we know that there's a mini-series we'll do and a series. And the series will run forever because there's so much information to be done on different states and different parts of the country and the connections in Europe and China and everywhere else, you know.
Yeah, it is very fascinating. I do have your book, Family Legacy, on order. I didn't get to get it in time before the interview, but I definitely look forward to checking it out.
You'll enjoy it. It's a good read.
Yeah, all the reviews I saw on it were very good.
Yeah, you'll like it.
Now, I also found out in my research that you played in the NFL. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was at a time, though, you know, you couldn't play in the NFL until your class graduated college then. There was no what they call today hardship cases. Like these kids leave in their freshman year and they go right into the NFL.
Right.
And that's the reason why they have so many injuries, because these kids aren't even done growing yet. You know, I think it's the dumbest thing they ever did, but they do it, you know. It's all about money. And when I played, you had, your class had to graduate, so you couldn't actually play pro ball till you were in your 20s, you know. And when I left school, and I got grabbed by the Jets, and they wanted me really bad in their system. So they had we played in the East Coast. There was a like a semi-pro football team. It'd be almost like farm baseball teams, you know?
Yeah.
Farm football teams where you would go and you'd play with certain teams and a lot of talent that was going to go up into the pros when they were eligible to go up. So I played with Dick Christie and his brother and a lot of pretty good ball players. And we played a couple games a week. I mean, to keep your levels and stuff up, you know. So when it came time for me to play, I sat down with New York and I said, you know, I have a lot of friends down in Philadelphia, and Philly had a great team. Jurgensen was down there, and Tommy McDonald and all. And the team was bought by a guy named Jerry Wallman, who was a great kid, but he didn't know football that well. But he bought the team because he was a Pennsylvania kid, and it was his life dream, and he had a lot of money, and him and Snyder was his partner, and Snyder became the owner of the Flyers. They booked the Flyers and the hockey team and the football team. But they hired this coach, Joe Cuharic, and he traded away a championship football team. I mean, I never saw in 3 months' time, Jurgensen was gone, Tommy McDonald was gone, running backs were gone, linemen were gone. he traded four guys to Green Bay for an old man, Jim Ringo, and he traded, I mean, just, it was unbelievable. So I remember coming out of a meeting one day, and Timmy Brown and I, and Timmy was a great running back. I don't know if you remember Timmy Brown.
I've heard the name.
He was a great ball player. And he was in the movie MASH. He was the black kid in MASH.
Oh, okay.
But he, Timmy was a super kid, a hell of a ball player. And we came out of the meeting one day, Kuharik walked right by, like, never even noticed you. And I turned around and I said, you don't talk to players anymore, man, or what's the deal? Oh, I said, you know what? Why are you trading all these people? Do me a favor, trade me too. And Timmy said, and by the way, trade me. And I had some friends in Philadelphia that said, you know, Al Lee had just won the title. And I said, you know, I can beat that guy. And they said, what a great idea. So next thing I know, I wind up in a gymnasium. And I was, and I couldn't box amateur because I was already considered a professional football. So I just went into the pros and started my boxing career.
Is that how it started? You just wanted to fight Al Lee?
Yeah. I said, I can beat that guy. And they said, well, so some serious guys in Philadelphia, there were a couple of gangsters, Sam Margolis, who owned Liston, and a few other fighters, and Blinky Palermo, and they put together a syndicate from North Jersey, and they took my contract, and I went into boxing. And then when I was, I think I was like 16-0, and I had a physical with a doctor one day, and he said, you know, you got a disease called acromegaly. And I said, so what the hell is acromegaly? He said, it's a tumor of your pituitary gland, and I don't know how you're fighting. You shouldn't be fighting at all. And I said, well, guess what? I like fighting. So he said, well, you shouldn't be doing this. Eventually, it's going to really harm you. And it caused real depression and shit in you and stuff like that. So they were wondering how I could even get up for a fight. But I just kept on going. I just did it. Then I stopped listening to people. And I was in my father's business, and so boxing was like a day game. You know, you had to have a day job to keep the law away from you. So boxing was like, and I would take fights on a week notice. You know, if I ever trained the way these guys train 2 or 3 months for a fight, shit, no one would ever beat me. I had a lot of natural talent, and I beat a lot of world fighters, you know, just on talent, you know. And I lost some decisions that I should have never lost, and anyway, but, you know, that's I don't cry over spilt milk. You know?
Right.
That's why I'm in several Hall of Fames, because I could fight. And Al Lee and I were signed to fight a couple times, and it just didn't work out. You know, and Frazier and I were supposed to fight once. That's a funny story. You know, I was in New Jersey, and they called me on the phone. They said, would you go to Houston and fight a kid named Terry Daniels? And I said, when? They said, next week. I said, yeah, good. Send me a ticket. He said, you'll take the fight? And I said, yeah. Terry Daniels was a ranked white kid who they were looking for a fight for Frazier for Houston Astrodome. And I said, yeah, no problem. And I went and I destroyed this kid because I was in pretty good shape. I had some indictments against me, so I couldn't run around the streets. I was in the house and I was training.
Right.
I got in pretty good shape. So I went, and I remember when I went down and the promoter said to me, my God, Jack, you're in really good shape. I said, well, aren't you supposed to be in shape when you come to a fight? So I destroyed this kid in 3 rounds, and I was on a plane going back to Philly, and Yank Doran was on the plane with me, and he said, Jack, you beat one more good fighter and you can have the Frazier fight. And I said, I'll tell you what better. I said, you give me a date and a time and send me an airline ticket and I'll show up. He said, are you kidding me? I said, what did I just tell you? You pick the fighter, pick the time and the place, and send me an airline ticket. So a week later, they called me up and said, you're fighting Cleveland Williams in Houston, Texas, who was a world-ranked fighter, and he was from Houston. And I said, no problem. So I beat Cleveland very badly. And Terry Daniels got the Frazier fight, and Cleveland Williams fought George Savallo in the same card. And then no one would fight me because I was in shape, you know. And it was kind of if I would have listened to certain people and done certain things, I had the right people in the right places, I could have moved right into the world championship, but I had to do it my way. I was, you know, I was just that hard-headed. I was like my father was very hard-headed. But I don't back on anything. I made mistakes, and you know, you live by them, and you just, you know, make yourself a better person.
Yeah, that's all any of us can do. Do you still keep?
And when I got there in the boxing business, they were trying to get me in the movie business. It came to me in '66. I was fighting up in Boston because I got into a rhubarb in Philly, and I was, I think I had 3 or 4 fights in Philly, and we used to have a club that I lived with a couple of the Eagles and stuff, and we hung at this. We had this club. At the classroom, they called it. It was a big disco thing and stuff. We were like the doormen and stuff like that. And I got into a bad rhubarb with a group of people, and some people got hurt. And anyway, so they had to ship me out of town. I wound up in Boston. And they were doing a picture of the Thomas Crown Affair with Steve McQueen. And we took care of Steve when he came in town. I looked after him, and he was a good kid. I really liked him. And he said, man, gotta come down, get on the set. He said, I'll get your green, your SAG card. He said, you come back to Hollywood, we'll have a great time, Jack. And I said, I'm undefeated as a fighter, and I kind of like Boston, and I'm doing some things here, and I don't think it's the right time for me to do that. And he said, no, man, you gotta do it. So I said, no, if I passed. And he went back to Hollywood, and he used to call me on the phone. He said, man, you gotta come out. Then I knocked the guy out, Manuel Ramos, in L.A., who was ranked 2 in the world. They were looking for him to fight Muhammad Ali. And I knocked him out in the 7th round in the Forum. And they came to me to do a picture of The Great White Hope with James Earl Jones. It was a big, big movie. And they thought they made a deal. Eddie Foy from Fox thought the deal was made. All I had to do was sign the contract. Because some people from back east were trying to get me off the street, and they made the deal for me to boom. And I didn't like, I said, I just knocked out the number 2 ranked heavyweight, and you want me to go to Spain for 6 months when I could fight for the title? And I think I'll pass. And they were scared to death. Oh my God, I remember Eddie Foy saying, you're going to get us killed, you're supposed to do this. And I said, don't worry. So I turned it down, and McQueen called me on the phone. He said, Jack, what is wrong with you? And then he did a picture. Called was it when he did a picture, and his name was Captain O'Halloran, and he called me up. He said, "Towering Inferno." He said, "How'd you like your name up on the screen, man?" So I blame it all on Robert Mitchum.
You became friends with Mitchum?
Oh, he became like a father. He was great. Robert was brilliant. He was the best mentor a person in the business could ever have, you know. And he just took me by the hand and showed me the technical aspects of it, because I had never been before a camera before.
Right.
You know. And he showed me this and showed me that, and told me that, you know, just be yourself, kid. Just take that character, put it in you, and walk down the street like the character. He said, you've been a hoodlum all your life, so you're playing a hoodlum, just be the hoodlum. So it worked out well. And the camera liked me, and that's a big important thing, you know. You can teach somebody some things in the business, but like I said to Mitchum one time, what is a star, man? And he said, it's a word called presence. Either you have it or you don't. The camera either likes you or it doesn't. And he said, you know, you take Marlon Brando and put him in front of any character he wants to play in any movie, and when you're walking out of the theater, you'll be saying, boy, Marlon was great doing this, Marlon was great doing that. And then you get a guy like Bill Holden, who was a really good actor, you know, technically, but he would do it. You'd be walking out of the theater and say, boy, that guy really did that well. What was his name? You know, it's a word called presence. You know, and I just... a lucky guy gave me a gift, and it worked out pretty well. So, and then Mitchum taught me what I needed to know. And it was Bob's your uncle. Down the street I went.
At least you had a good mentor, someone that helped you.
Oh, he was the best. Robert was the governor. He was terrific. He was an amazing individual. He was probably the most well-read man I ever met in my life. Robert was a gas. He was a great actor.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen him in lots of stuff.
Oh, he was a great actor. I mean, he's probably one of the most underrated actors in the country. because he didn't give a shit. You know, he liked what he did. He did what he wanted. You know, he did a lot of movies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, King Kong and Superman, to a much larger extent, are kind of your most well-known roles. How did you land parts in each of those?
Well, when Farewell My Lovely came out, you know, they offered me a lot of stuff. I turned a lot of stuff down. But King Kong was they had a great script, and there was a great cast. And you know, Jesse Lang's first picture, and Jeff Bridges is a good guy, and Charlie Grodin's a good guy. And so I said, yeah, to the picture. And it was a long shoot. Like, we shot for 9 months.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of cool, you know. And when I was doing that, they offered me the Bond movie, and I turned it down. No, I didn't. That was, I was doing March or Die, the movie after. Well, I'd signed to do March or Die. When I got done King Kong, I went right to March or Die, and they came to me to do the Bond movie rather than do March or Die. And I said, well, I've already signed the contract to do it. And Gene Hackman was doing it, and Catherine Deneuve, and Ian Holm, and some really good actors. So I kind of liked the idea of going to Spain and different parts of the world and doing this Foreign Legion movie. And so I turned down the Bond movie. And while I was doing the Foreign Legion movie, they offered me Superman. So I went from one film to another, you know, just Superman was a couple years.
Yeah. Did you read the comics at all when you were a kid, or was it just something, just a job?
Superman was the very first American hero.
Right.
So super villain, you know, I mean, a superhero. And everybody read comic books about the character, you know. But when I read the script and, we were down in Spain, and they flew Hackman and I up, because Hackman and I were doing March or Die together. So they flew us up to meet Richard Donner, and Donner and I had a great conversation. And he said, well, you know, if we do this guy with a mute thing, does it bother you? And I said, no. I said, actually, I would embrace that, because Jackie Gleason was a friend of mine, and he did a picture called Zhigo that won him an Oscar playing a deaf, dumb mute. I said, if I ever get a chance to do a role like that, I'm going to embrace it. And Nan was the perfect character, because Terrence was a vicious general. Sarah was a man-eater. So somebody had to relate to the kids, you know, because it was a big child audience. So I took this brutish, big character and played him like a child, learning how to work my eyes and learning, you know, and it worked really well. You know, it was good.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I saw it, I was real young, and Non definitely left an impression. Did you find it a little more challenging to just rely on, like, your facials and stuff?
That's what I said. I embraced doing it. I wanted to do that.
Right.
It was, you know, it's a great, I mean, I did another picture with Chuck Norris, Hero in the Terror. And I played a guy who doesn't talk, and that came off terrific as well. You know, so, I embraced that. To be able to use your body language and facial expression and get a message across and get it across strongly, you know. I mean, I remember the first Comic-Con I did after Superman, and some kids and people came up to me and they said, my God, you can actually talk? They thought I was definitely a mute, man, you know. So I must have done something pretty good, you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely, for sure.
And the people come up to me and said, boy, your character, I'm scared to death of it, but I love the character so much, you know. And that made me feel good. The kids, I didn't scare the shit out of them to where they actually fell in love with the character that was, you know, so it was kind of cool. It means that guy did what I was there to do.
No, definitely.
It worked out.
How was Marlon Brando on set?
Marlon was great.
He
Marlon
was
terrific. Marlon and I were good friends. And he knew my father. He's a New York guy. And he did War on the Waterfront. That's about my Uncle Tony. So, you know, Marlon was dying to meet me. I remember going down the set, and Mitchum said to me, go down and tell that bum I said hello. And I said, yeah, okay. So the first day Mark Brando came over, I went down on the set to see him. And he was surrounded by reporters and all that jazz. And he saw me, broke right through to him, and ran over to me, "Hey kid, how you doing? Blah 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 blah," and we became really good friends. I liked Marlon. Marlon was a brilliant actor. I mean, you know, when guys like him come on the set, you can hear a pin drop. You know, and I used to go down and watch him work. And the first 11 days that we're filming him to get him on money, to get the money from a bank. You know.
Yeah.
So we did the first scenes that we do in Superman was with Marlon. You know, so it worked out really kind of cool. You know, and I went down and watched him work a couple of times because I really appreciated what he did. And I saw him do something I never saw anybody do before. He had cue cards everywhere. And there was a technical problem with the camera. He was in the middle of a shot, and the guy yelled, "Oh, got a problem with the camera." And they said they were going to scrap the shot and come back. And Marlon said, "No, fix the camera." And he turned around, and they turned back into the shot, and he finished it. I never saw anybody do that before. And he came back off the set, and I said to him, "You know what?" I said, "I guess the people would be a little nervous asking him, what the hell is it? What is with all the cue cards, man? Are you that bored with the industry that you got to have cue cards everywhere?" And he said, no. He said, I started that on Mutiny in the Bounty because I didn't want the camera to think that I had studied this script or anything. I wanted to make it look like I was taking the verbiage out of the air." And I looked at him and I said, "Yeah, it's bullshit, man." And he laughed, and he was a great Shakespearean actor. And he sat there and he ripped off a couple parables of Shakespeare word for word. And he looked at me and he said, "That you must know word for word. This stuff, piece of cake."
Oh yeah.
You know, he was kind of a really good guy. What an actor. I mean, God, he was incredible.
Oh, an absolute legend. One of the more well-known aspects of Superman 2 is that Richard Donner was fired, or they came to an impasse during filming. How did you guys, the cast and crew, react to that?
It really irked me because I almost didn't go back, and the Hackman never came back.
Oh, really?
And Christopher Reeve should have stood up and said to Saul Kinz, "Either Diner or you don't have me." And they would have brought Donner right back. They didn't want to pay him.
Oh, really?
How do you cut Marlon Brando out of a picture? The footage was already shot. Marlon Brando's not in Superman 2, the Lester cut, but he is in his own, the Donner cut. Have you ever seen the Donner cut?
I believe I have.
Cut's great. That's all Brando's in that all the way through.
Yeah, I'm going to have to make a point to watch it.
Yeah, they didn't want to pay him the points. They'd already paid him a salary. They'd already shot all the footage, but they didn't want to pay the points to him, so they cut him out and put this, what's her face in? His mother, Superman's mother, played.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that, yeah, when he gives up his power.
You know, that's just the Saul Kinz. And they were foolish because if Donner would have done finished two, he would have done 3, 4, 5, and 6. It would have been a whole different franchise.
Yeah, it seemed like it kind of fell off after two.
He was a brilliant director. Richard Donner was a brilliant, brilliant director.
Do you still have any kind of relationship with him?
Yeah, I talk to him every once in a while. Yeah, he's around. Yeah.
That's good. How was it working with Christopher Reeve? Reeves.
Chris was, you know, he was a young kid. That was his first picture that he ever did anything, you know. And he should thank Donner every day of his life. Donner brought a performance out of him that was, there'll never be another Superman like Christopher Reeve. He did Superman and Clark Kent roles so perfectly. It was brilliant. I mean, he was a pain in the ass because he was young and naive, but he was great. What he put on screen, they'll never match that.
No, he still is. Even people my age who came along a little bit later, he's still the Superman that we think of.
Oh, yeah. No, we're talking about doing another Superman movie, and because of the technology that's available with hologram and stuff, we would bring Christopher back. And we have a great storyline. We just may pull it off. This might happen.
No, that sounds
good. Fan base cool. Will go crazy.
Definitely. So you get now I see concerts with like holographs of people who have passed, like Michael Jackson and stuff. So it's very doable.
Oh, they did it in the movie when Philip Seymour Hoffman died halfway through the film, and they finished the movie with him, and people swore he was there. but it was a hologram, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So can it be done? Oh yeah, it can be done, positively.
Oh, for sure. Do you have a favorite role that you've played so far throughout your movie career?
I'm very partial to Farewell, My Lovely, because of Mitchum, I think. But then Superman was a great role. I mean, I don't think I've ever done a bad role. I mean, I handpicked movies very carefully what I did. King Kong was probably, I think the weakest role I did was the Flintstones, and that was only because the footage was cut. That was the first time I was ever cut out of a picture, and they did it because Liz Taylor was in the movie, and they had so many stars in the film, and they made room for Liz Taylor, so they cut some of the footage out. They trimmed it back, and the director was a bit of a zip. So it was the first time I mean, I had done some great scenes with Rosie O'Donnell at the gate of the quarry and stuff, really funny stuff. In fact, they wanted me to do a commercial for one of the hamburger companies because it was really clever what we'd done. And I was getting ready to do that, and I got a call and I said, "Well, we're going to scrap this because they cut the footage out of the film." And I called the producer. I said, "What the hell is this all about?" He said, "Well, they made room for Liz Taylor." And I said, "Okay. God bless you." But that's Hollywood, so.
Yeah, that's a movie I'm very familiar with. I was right at that age when it came out.
Baltimore Bullet is a great movie. If you never saw that, you should see it. Jimmy Coburn and Omar Sharif. And Bruce Boxleitner's first movie. And it was about, we shot the actual nine ball tournament down at MGM that year. We had every pool hustler in the world in the film. It was great. Moscone, everybody. So it was kind of cool. We had a good time doing it.
Oh
And
yeah,
Omar Sharif is brilliant. Sharif is a brilliant actor.
I'll definitely check it out. I'm into the older movies.
Yeah, Baltimore Bullet's a good film. You'll like it. March or Die is a good film, but Dragnet's a great film with Dan Aykroyd and Tom Hanks.
Yeah, I have seen that one.
That's Tom Hanks' breakout. In fact, you can watch Dragnet 50 times, and you still won't get all the one-liners that Danny says in that. He threw out so many one-liners. It was great. Yeah, a lot of fun working with him.
Was that a lot of, did they do a lot of improv on that movie?
Danny does improv all the time. Aykroyd's
Yeah.
Aykroyd. He gets away with it too. But it's all good. It worked out very well.
Oh yeah. Let me see. What are you working on right now? Anything in particular? I know
Well,
you.
first of all, we're building a major studio in Nevada. And once this pandemic slows down, and we're getting ready to do Family Legacy. And we were going to do a film, but now we're looking at doing a mini series because there's so much information and you couldn't jam it all in a 2-hour movie. So we're going to do a mini series that'll go into a series, and the series will make Boardwalk Empire and Sopranos look like kids' game because we're going to really tell the truth about a lot of things in organized crime that no one ever dared talk about.
That sounds very interesting. Are you ever worried that someone might come to you and say, hey, maybe you shouldn't tell the whole truth, or?
Nobody would dare. I wrote the book, and they nobody, because I have a right to mention any names I want to. That's my bloodline. I can do what I want.
Oh, for sure.
And if you read the book, you'll find out who I really am, because the character is me as a kid, and nobody, like I said, nobody says boo to me. What I want to do.
Yeah, there's got to be lots of freedom to that, being able to do whatever you
Yeah,
want.
no, it's as long as you're not doing anything to harm anybody or harm the families, and it's not harming him, it's putting things right, and turning things around. I mean, where you're from, Russell Bufalino ran all that up there, and he used to come watch me box in Scranton. I had a couple fights in Scranton, And he, they were super people. They took care of everybody up in the whole area. You know, people in Scranton that were struggling weren't struggling because Russell was there, and he made sure people had jobs. And he was kind of a pretty good guy. Probably one of the most well-connected political dons in the country at his time. He was very close to Washington. So, I mean, there were a lot of meetings in little towns around in Western Pennsylvania. There was kind of funny. I used to go up and see all these limousines and stuff, people from Washington. And when I was a kid, they, you got to come see this. And, you know, so it was kind of fun. And I remember Pittsburgh. When Pittsburgh, the air was so thick, the pollution was terrible. But they've cleaned it up. Pittsburgh's a pretty neat city now. They've cleaned it up a lot. And Johnstown, my father owned own dressing manufacturers up there in that whole area, Altoona and all that shit.
Oh, yeah.
He had three or four companies up there.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, it's nowadays there ain't much going on in Johnstown, Altoona area. We get stuff in spurts, but...
Yeah, but it was kind of a neat... It was, you know, Pennsylvania is like a pretty neat state. No one really understands how much greenery there is in Pennsylvania. You know, when you drive out, everybody thinks of Harrisburg or Philadelphia, but they don't think of the mountain Poconos, and you go on western Pennsylvania. That's a gorgeous state to drive through.
Oh, it definitely
is. The Mennonite area up there is kind of beautiful, and where the farms are, where the Amish are.
Yeah.
It's kind of a neat country, boy. And I used to like them. I used to go up there. They told me, you ever get in trouble, come hide out here. We'll take care of you. They'll never find you.
Oh, no. I live out in the...
They didn't use telephones and stuff. They didn't have phones and that, you know. They were pretty cool people. I kind of liked them a lot.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like it would have been really cool.
They were great farmers. I mean, wow. That's where the Pennsylvania tomato come from. Pennsylvania tomatoes were unbelievable. Big beef tomatoes.
Yeah. That's
a question.
I'm surrounded by farm country.
Yeah, it's gorgeous up there. You know, people just think Pennsylvania, they think of Philadelphia. You know, cities, you know what I mean?
Yep.
It's like New York. Everybody thinks New York is Manhattan. But upstate New York is beautiful. Huge country up there. Man, it's out in the wilderness, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Saratoga and all those places. And people don't have no idea sometimes. It makes me laugh.
Yeah, they just...
Western Pennsylvania is kind of... In fact, my father, that's how I was conceived. My father, they were looking for him everywhere. After they executed his partner, Louis Lipke, they were looking for Albert everywhere. It was in the newspapers, blah, 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 blah. And he was in the Army as a sergeant, teaching soldiers how to be longshoremen at Indian Gap, Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow.
There was an Army base there. And he was in the Army, and he used to go, but he never spent a night there. He would go into Philly every night, and that's how he met my mother. And that's how I came about. But he was in the Army. And one of the funny stories was a guy, he was like I said, they were looking for him everywhere in the newspapers, and where's Albert on the stage, and da, da, da. And the captain of his platoon was reading the New York newspaper, and he called the police in New York, and he said, this Albert Anastasia guy you are looking for. The guy said, who? They said, yeah, you're looking for, I'm reading the newspaper, you're looking all over for this Albert Anastasia guy. He said, I got him right here in my army. He's in my platoon here. And the guy said, hold on a minute. And he came back on the phone, and that's how much power they had. And they said, oh, he said, that's a bunch of malarkey. We're really not looking for Albert Anastasia. That's just all newspaper stuff. And he was right there in Indian Gap, Pennsylvania.
And that was real cool.
Isn't far from you.
No, not at all.
No.
That's a small world.
And he used to drive into Philly every night, you know, go to dinner and clubs and shit.
That's a long drive. I think Philly is like 4 hours, maybe 3.5 hours with all the new freeways.
Yeah, something like that. Well, you go down there, he never spent a night in Indian Gap. He spent nights down. It's nice down in Philadelphia. But, you know.
Yeah.
So that's all good. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Now we're getting ready. I'm writing a couple more books, and my friend and I, Charlie Lucianison, and I are going to collaborate on a couple things, and we're going to have a lot of fun. It's good.
That sounds good. You're writing more books, he said?
Yeah. There'll be another book out in about 60 days.
Oh, really?
You'll be able to read this one, then you'll read the next one. It'll be right behind it.
Yeah. What's the title of this one, the one coming?
It'll be Family Legacy, The Final Cut.
The Final
Cut. That's what we're going to
tell you.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll definitely be keeping an eye out for it. Maybe we can get you back on after it comes out and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Just let me know.
Yeah. Couple more questions, and then I can let you go. With all that you have accomplished, being an NFL player, a professional boxer, actor, author, is there anything left besides doing your miniseries and your series, anything left that you haven't done yet that you'd like to?
I don't know. I just, whatever comes up in life, you know. I've helped a lot of people in different problems and stuff. You know.
I do have one more question about boxing and we can wrap it up.
Sure.
Is there anyone that you're a fan of coming up through the ranks? And MMA has kind of taken over, sort of, as the most popular combat sport. Do you follow MMA or?
Oh, I think MMA is childish, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Not a comparison to boxing, as far as I'm concerned.
What do you?
You know, there's a couple of young fighters that are doing bringing boxing back alive. I mean, the Gypsy is he really can fight, this guy. And he'll beat Joshua and he'll beat Wilder again, you know, because
Tyson Fury. Tyson Fury?
Yeah.
Yep.
He can fight. He really has the ability to fight. He's got fast hands, he's got good footwork, he's a big guy. And he's got a lot of agility for a big guy. And he's got a hell of a chin.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So I mean, he's gonna be there and they're gonna have a tough time beating him, boy. If he can stay off the booze and shit, you know, he'll be a hell of an opponent for a couple of years.
Oh,
you know, they're just boxing. I mean, God, let me tell you something. If someone would have given me $1 million to get in the ring, you'd have to bring a gun in that ring to beat me. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh yeah.
So, I mean, these guys. When I started boxing, we got $10 a round.
Wow,
you fight a 4-round fight, you got $40. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You had to love the sport if you're going to play, you know?
Right.
I had a syndicate that gave me a salary every week. Thank God, or I'd have never done it. You know, I wouldn't have done it. But, you know, when you first started boxing, Ali's the one that brought money into boxing.
Was he like the first superstar of boxing, you think, Ali?
Oh, he was a great guy. I mean, there were some great fighters. I knew great fighters before him. And Willie Pep, I knew a lot of great fighters. But Ali Muhammad Ali would have been great in any sport he played. He was just a great athlete, period. And one of the nicest guys you ever meet in your life, when you ever sat down and talked to him one-on-one, one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet in your life. I liked Ali quite a bit. He and I were good friends.
Yeah, it's a shame that he couldn't really talk the last...
Well, you know, he had a disease. What happened to him in reality is that his camp up in Pennsylvania, where he had a training camp up there, and he was right next to a mink farm. And they sprayed the mink farm all the time for rodents and stuff. Oh. And he's out doing his road work, and he poisoned himself. Not even realizing it. When they thought that he had certain things, these young kids in Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania, did a blood analogy of him, and they found out that it broke his system down to Parkinson's and stuff. And it was really sad what happened to him, because he was just such a great person. I just, you know, I felt bad for him. And he was a good friend, like I said.
Yeah, that really is unfortunate. Did you ever think about, like, training anybody, or once you were gone in the movies, that was it?
I did Frankie Lyles. I made him world champion.
Well, yeah, I just meant, like turning him, like a factory type thing, like.
No, I left that for Freddie. Freddie did. Freddie's chained out a lot of champions since then. He became one of the biggest trainers in the business today.
Yeah.
Freddie really knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I see him on ESPN interviewing and stuff quite a bit.
And Freddie's a good kid. I like him a lot.
Well, I mean, we could go on forever. You have so much to your story, and there's so much more I'd like to get into, so maybe we can have you back one day.
Yeah, just let me know.
Yeah, 'cause I've really enjoyed our conversation. I want to thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to
This is
speaking with
my
you.
pleasure.
As you heard, Jack has a very interesting story, and I do look forward to reading his book and learning maybe a bit more about him. It is a fictionalized version of his childhood, I guess. Some real stuff, maybe some made up from, everything that I read on it, 'cause I did look into it quite a bit. Now, I will be bringing you Friday the 13th, Part 4, the final chapter, here within the next few days to a week, but it is coming, and I am going to be doing more of these interviews, but I'm going to also still be doing my normal reviews. I'll be finishing up the Friday series, and my cousin TK is going to be joining me for Part 6 and Part 7. Some of these interviews might be sprinkled in with my Friday the 13th reviews, so you just have to look for it. But if you subscribe, you'll get all the episodes as soon as they drop. The only thing is there might be a little lag time between each of the episodes, but try to branch out. Well, thank you for listening, and be on the lookout because the next episode that'll be coming at you will be Friday the thir my review of Friday the 13th, the final chapter.